Please, can I record this?
Sure.
Thank you. I'm so glad to meet you. It's been a long time coming.
Yes.
How are you coping with all of this, though?
I really dislike just being at home this way and isolated, but, you know, it's fine.
I know, right? I know. So just a brief kind of overview of what I intend to do, like my thought process. So for the DAS 50th anniversary, even though we might not be able to do that this year from the look of things, but we are really thinking of going on with the online presence, some sort of online presence that we have to do. So a part of that will be just coming up with a podcast, better still, telling the story of how, kind of like the history, the timeline of how CAS progressed into being DAS. And kind of like the ups and downs. So basically, I think what I want to capture, because we have different beats and pieces to this project. But from my own angle, what I'm trying to tell, I mean, our audience, basically, from according to Professor Matthew, is our alumni, our students, wanted to be more student-focused, so to speak. So I would like to tell a story about our CAS became a department, which I knew was much around in 2011. I mean, I like to take some of the, I won't say battles, well, maybe some of the fights, some of the back and forth that went into it, some of the success stories, basically, like how have we evolved over time? How has it been? Looking back, I mean, you've been here before I was even born, probably. Looking back, would you say we have actually progressed a lot? We have achieved some of the goals and stuff like that. So these are some of my questions for today, but please, I mean, I just want you to be as expressive as much as you can, if time allows us today, and I would try to get as much as I could. Thank you so much for this. I really am grateful.
Sure.
So I think I'll just start with the first, because that's a piece I am really missing. That's what I have not been able to find from the resources that are online. What actually went into CAS being DAS? Like, how did it all start?
Yeah. So, you know, I was going to try and look through some of my documents here to, you know, find the exact dates. But basically, it was a process that had a few different stages in it. And it was part of a larger moment where a number of small, a number of interdisciplinary programs wanted to have more power and influence, wanted to be able to exert more control over what they were doing. So it was American culture, women's studies, DAS, and I think comparative literature. So it's kind of, you know, women and ethnic studies, you know, they were all programs, you know, that were fighting for more authority. And so the first thing that happened is that they became augmented programs, which gave them a little bit more power and control. They could do hiring on their own. They could tenure, which is a big thing, whether or not you're a unit that has the power to both hire a faculty member and tenure a faculty member is a big thing. So, you know, there was a whole, you know, moment of, I don't know, maybe 3 to 5 years where all of these programs got this augmented status, including what was then CAS. So that was a big hurdle, right, to be able to be augmented. And then there was a period of time where the augmentation kind of grew and developed. CAS got its own faculty lines, which is another big thing. I mean, it's like having your own real estate, you know, if you can control your own faculty lines, then that gives you a lot of authority. And so the augmentation and authority grew, and it grew to the point where CAS was finally able to go through the process to request full departmentalization.
So that happened in 2011, right?
That's right.
So you're saying, from what I heard now, is the big thing that changed was the ability to be able to do tenure tracking.
to do
tenure tracking, like for faculty members? Like, what's the significance for you when it changed to DAS? Like, what changed actually?
When it changed from the
center? Okay, again.
Almost nothing. Okay. So the big changes right at the end, you know, we're really changing the name and changing the letterhead. It wasn't, you know, I mean, it just, by that point, it just didn't matter. In fact, I argued against departmentalization.
Oh, why?
Because it didn't matter. I mean, the CAS had all of the power and authority and control that it really needed. And from my point of view, departmentalization didn't add anything that wasn't just, largely symbolic at that point.
Oh, really? That was actually good to know, because my discussions with Professor was, and one of his own, from his own point of view, was like the only thing that probably changed was because DAS could now give tenure tracking or tenure track. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, that, right. So it's whether or not, you own your own faculty lines.
Okay.
Can you hire on your own? Oh. And can you tenure on your own?
Okay.
So those are the three big things. But CAS could already do that before departmentalization.
Oh. Okay. So nothing really changed, basically.
No, the letterhead, you know, the name. But here's the thing. So I thought it was, you know, kind of a lot of trouble for not that much, you know, okay. in practical, concrete mm-hmm. terms, right? And in terms of power.
Mm-hmm.
But symbolically, I think it was a huge thing for people. So for years, people had been wanting CAS to become its own department. And so I think people saw that as a victory. Mm. And it's a symbolic victory, you know, and sometimes that's really important.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, I didn't know that even tenure track was actually possible for CAS.
Oh, yeah.
Alone before they became DAS.
Yeah.
So that was good to know.
That's right. Because it was an augmented program.
I mean, so kind of like restructuring what you just said. So it wasn't as if we gained more autonomy. CAS always had it before now.
It had had it since the time it became an augmented program.
Oh.
So at least, five or six years before departmentalization, it was fully empowered.
Okay. But you could say that. So go ahead.
What was interesting is that people, and so I met with students, I met with alums.
Okay.
I tried to explain that this mm-hmm. wasn't really that big, but nobody believed it.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to hear it from you, from coming out from you right now. It's just so different. Okay, yeah. But the augmentation actually helped.
That's right. That was the big hurdle.
That was the big hurdle.
That had been at least 5 years before departmentalization.
So just to understand the term augmentation, was it the fact that it joined other departments? What do you really mean by that?
So a number of programs,
yes,
CAS, Women's Studies, American mm-hmm. Culture, and I think Comparative Literature all became augmented programs before they became departments.
I guess what does it really mean to be augmented? What does it mean for a program to be augmented program?
So more powerful in terms of being able to control faculty lines, really.
Oh.
You know,
okay.
And you become, you know, part okay. of a more structured budget process. And there are a few mm-hmm. other things that happen, but that's the big thing.
Okay.
And then of all the programs that became augmented, American Culture augmented. Was the last one to departmentalize.
Oh. Okay. I actually had something about, like, how we got into Avon Orr from my interview with Beth.
Oh.
And it was actually very informative as well. She was just on and on. She had told me about how they wanted, like, stuff to be together, like some sort of collaboration.
Oh, because, to move, yeah.
Yes, right, right. Yes, yeah. Kind of have some, yeah, some eye tower of ethnic structure, something.
And that was, yeah, that never really happened, but
yeah, really,
yeah. That kind of stuff looks good on paper, but you can't make people then do that stuff, right?
That's so true.
Although, so there's always been a tight relationship between caste and DAS and American culture,
even till dates. Yeah, kind of. Okay, so what would you say has actually changed? Just looking at, I mean, you said it clearly, nothing has changed, but has there been any improvement, really? Because I was actually listening to the interview where BAM was celebrating 20 years. I think it was Cynthia Stevens. She was talking about the fruits of BAM, like how we're not there yet, so we're hoping to get there. I mean, we're trying to, you know, request or make requests with an institution. We're dealing with an institution, and we ourselves are not institution, like we're not institutionalized. So what would you say have changed from BAM at 20 to now that we're doing BAM at 50? That's 30 years.
Wow. Yeah, that's a hard one to figure out.
I know.
So, I mean, if you look at the things that the original BAM wanted, right? Yeah. I mean, if you go back and look at the list of demands, mm-hmm. You know, one thing to ask is, how many of those things succeeded?
Yeah.
Right. So then you never really got to the 10% request.
Yes.
You know, that never happened. But CAS became, you know, an established program and led to the hiring of a lot of faculty of color, African American faculty. I mean, that definitely happened. So CAS, we still do this to some extent. We tend to hire with other departments.
Okay.
Especially the disciplines, sociology, psychology, philosophy, economics, history. Because the college really wanted CAS and now DAS to be able to help to diversify the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And that has happened. I mean, it's you know, but because the college, you know, has given DAS the actual resources to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, when you look back to the original moment of BAM, I think it would have been hard to think about such an empowered center and now department. And so I think that that's a real success story.
Yeah, it is. It is.
But I mean, it depends on where you put the bar. But if you're putting the bar at, you know, is the University of Michigan still a racist institution? Well, yeah, right? I mean, so,
Well, yeah, that's subjective, right? Yeah.
So I think it depends on what, you know, where are you putting the bar and what are your metrics for, you know, did it succeed? I mean, so I think what BAM started is a kind of intergenerational relay race.
Yeah.
And that we're still running that race.
We are.
And that, so now DAS is kind of, this generation of leadership of DAS is playing its role in something that's just going to continue to be an ongoing struggle.
Mm-hmm. That's so true.
And so you don't see it as success because you never get there, but you still have to keep running.
Mm-hmm.
And then try not to lose too much ground.
Yeah. I guess that's so true. I remember sharing it with a colleague at work that if there's something I missed most about not being on campus, it's the fact that when you're in even awe, we call ourselves, I mean, there was a time we made a joke about having the feel of being in the United Nations. Because it just seems as if there's somebody represented from everywhere all over the world. And that sense of belonging is just a beautiful experience. And so going back to some of the objectives and some of the requests that the negotiators had asked for during the BAM one, you know, the fact that they want, you mentioned clearly that we didn't meet the 10%. I mean, we're still struggling with that.
We came close though at one point.
We are?
We came at one point. We had come really close.
Really? My question.
The number got to something like 9.3 or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Because that was going to be my follow-up question, that right now, where are we at currently?
Oh. Because
it's been how many years ago? Even though Beth was saying we have struggles retaining students, I mean, you could only, there's just a limit to what you could do. It still has to be the department, or I mean the school, trying to make financial aid, making life easier for those folks. Yeah, but I was just curious, how has it evolved in the sense that to achieve that enrollment? Because that was one big thing. I mean, in fact, I circled it on my notes while I was going through it. Over time, it kept up recurring. That was one big thing they were really clamoring for. Like, they wanted to increase Black presence on campus. Though it wasn't only for students. I mean, also amongst Black faculty, even though it seems as if the student is the university is making conscious efforts towards that. It's just that the student ratio, like, what do you think generally about that, I guess? I think my question precisely would be, yeah, where we're at right now, and what are the ways, how can we make this really better? Because these guys, I mean, the folks of BAM 1970 put in a lot, their lives were at stake, their careers were at stake, just to see these things we're seeing. In fact, I personally used to thank God I wasn't alive those days, because it just felt like it was a lot. Hearing the testimonies and the videos was just so.
Yeah. Well, I think you know, one way of looking at it is that there are a lot of things that happen. So there's BAM.
Yeah.
And then there was the moment of the Michigan mandate, which is kind of late 80s,
okay,
maybe very early 1990s, which is, and that was the moment where we got really close to that 10% African-American student number.
So was the Michigan mandate before BAM?
No, it's after BAM.
Okay, after 1980s.
Right. So okay. Some people associate it with BAM 3.
Oh.
So the Michigan mandate was right after, like some point in the mid 1980s, there were all of these racist incidents on campus.
Okay.
Including one from this radio station that was just telling all these racist jokes.
I know, I mean, yes.
Just wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And then that led to like another moment of real activism. They took over the Fleming building. Actually, this is such an interesting story. Rob Sellers, who's now the chief diversity officer at Michigan,
oh,
as a graduate student, was part of that protest.
Wow.
So in the late 80s, he protested to create the job that he now has.
I mean, oh, like, my goodness.
In fact, I'm gonna look him up. If you remind me, I've got an old newspaper clipping of him holding up the tape from the racist radio broadcast during the moment where they're occupying Fleming. So a lot of stuff came out of that moment. Barbara Ramsby was on campus as a graduate student. They were doing a lot of anti-racist work that led to the founding of the Baker Mandela Center. You know, it was a really big moment on campus, and that really helps to launch the Michigan mandate. And the Michigan mandate gets us closest to that undergraduate enrollment number than I think we've ever been, and unleashes a lot of resources to start hiring faculty of color in really large numbers.
Yeah.
So a lot of us here now are actually, our appointments are on lines that were authorized at that moment.
Hmm.
So it was a really, you know, it was a huge thing, you know. So I think there's, you know, so there's the early BAM, there's the moment of the Michigan mandate. And then I think it's, you know, the moment after we could no longer use affirmative action. That, you know, that these are three really distinctive periods. And so it's not, you know, I mean, history is never a straight line because the context is always shifting. And in an environment where you can no longer legally use affirmative action, it's going to be a lot harder, you know, to try and keep the enrollment up and expand. I mean, it's just been tough.
I guess.
Although enrollment of Black and Brown students started to drop well before Proposition 2.
Why?
I don't know. You know, the university kept, like, you know, talking about diversity, and we're doing less and less structurally to get there. I don't know. You know, it's just kind of like the rhetoric ran into reality, you know, in a really, you know, in a really stark way. I don't know. I think a lot of things changed at the university. It was becoming more competitive.
Yeah.
You know, the admission stuff was just exploding, or all these applications. And I think in that environment, the commitment, you know, to having more Black and Brown students just started slipping.
Wow, that would have been my follow-up question. So are you saying that the university is no longer committed to some of the requests they consented to during BAM1 and other struggles that happened on campus?
Not really. I mean, I think a lot of people right now are committed to it, but we don't have access to the same tools to make it happen.
That's true.
You know, and here's another thing that's happened more recently. So the university has gotten more committed to low income and first generation college students. Mm. This is so important, right? So I think the president of the university says that he wants to get to around 20% low income students. Mm. This is a huge commitment, you know, and a public institution should have those kinds of numbers. But that's white people.
Oh, that doesn't include any Black
people. No, no, it does. Okay. But there are far more white people that are in the profile than Black people. So as you try and increase socioeconomic diversity, it gets harder to have ethnic and racial diversity.
Wow.
I know, isn't that interesting?
I know.
So, I mean, another way of putting it is to say that class is not a proxy for race. It just isn't.
Oh, I mean, that makes sense, I guess. Yeah.
Because there are way more poor white people out there. I mean, that's a huge number of people, you know. And then the Black population is just going to be a subset of that. But, you know.
It's what it is.
That's right. So you've got two really important things, racial and ethnic diversity, and then class diversity that are bamming into each other. So, you know, if you're like the chief admissions enrollment officer, how do you solve that? I mean, you know, she doesn't know. I mean, she would love to be able to solve it.
There's a limit to what she could do, I guess.
That's right. Her name is Kedra Issop. Okay. She's a really cool, thoughtful person, Black woman. You know, I mean, yeah, she would love to be able to, you know, solve this puzzle, but it's a hard one to do.
Well, thank you so much. When did you join the school, though?
I got here in 2006.
Oh, and from my findings, you were the, I think then they were called directors. Yes. Yes. I think you were probably the last director. Yes. Yes. Just remembering that. Yeah, you were. What are your experiences? I don't know if this is the right thing. I don't know if I can put in the right way I could. So Elizabeth was saying that I think Niara Sudaska.
Oh, uh-huh.
Did a lot. I mean, she was really involved with the old BAM thing and the old BAM struggles thing and the fight and how they got to where they got to. But she mentioned something just in passing that I kind of like grabbed. She said she didn't become the director up until later. I mean, I think she was like the fifth or the sixth. I guess what I'm going to is, like, what would you say? Framing it is just male and female, like back, you know what I'm trying to say, like faculty members, like, do we have equal, when it comes to like this kind of positions, especially in our like amongst ourselves in our community, in caste and das, so to speak, what would you say the ratio was? Like, how would you say the your experience generally was about that?
Yeah, well, so I think I lived through the tail end of like the kind of the male dominated
that is
it. Caste, you, yes. know? You know, I mean, it is true. They were just, you know, whew, you know, and both the, you know, and both the American side, so those of us doing Afro-Am, and certainly that the African studies side. I mean, they were, you know, these guys they took up a lot of space. And I think, you know, at that point, there hadn't been a lot of women that had ever served as director. There was this other woman too, but they ran her out in like a year.
Yes, I know, right? Like, it was just so, I mean, she just said it in passing, but I kind of took note of it, and I was like, it's been a long time coming, like all of these things.
Yes. Yes. So, you know, but now it's been, you know, I mean, things shifted. So mm-hmm. I was director, and then Taya Miles was chair, the first chair of DAS.
Yeah.
Followed by Frida Okoto. Yeah. You know, so it was like the reign of the women, you know.
You kind of opened the door, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, so now it's much more, it's much more of a sense of gender balance as well.
Okay.
You know, and you can even see it. So, you know, we've developed real strengths in like Black women's history, Black feminist thought, that kind of stuff, you know, especially at the point where Martha Jones was still here and Sherry Randolph and, you know, Yeah, so that was a real sea change, definitely.
Okay. Personally, like, what would you think has been the greatest achievement of DAS, like, since we formally, officially became a department?
Huh. Well, so remember, I mean, from my point of view, departmentalization is not that big.
Yes.
Thing, right?
Yeah, well,
so, I think so, from the point of being an augmented program forward, mm-hmm. I think maybe the biggest achievement is getting people to understand that there's nothing that what we're doing in our scholarship and our teaching is distinctive, that it's important, and that we don't need to justify it. Do you know what I mean? That we can just do what we're doing.
Without explaining.
You know, without this sense of, oh, well, but see, our scholarship is just as good as the other. You know what I mean? We don't have to do that anymore. And I mean, and that's a nice position to be in, you know. Hmm. You know, and we have, you know, in the affiliated with the department, all of these senior scholars, people who have really, you know, made their careers and have in a lot of cases entered into high level administrative positions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you could count me, you could count people like Al Young, Elizabeth Cole. So our interim dean has a DAS appointment. Black woman. In fact, people who know about the number of faculty of color, especially African American faculty, in high level administrative positions at Michigan are astonished. I mean, so you don't often see us all together, so I think people don't realize how many of us there are, but it's huge.
There's more like this, I would say, a significant Black presence. I mean, the consciousness, I guess. People are more aware. And I think we've gotten to that more acceptable. I know, like you said, there must still be some sort of racism. I mean, you can't stop. Yes, you can't stop what other people think or feel about you.
That's right.
But we're more aware.
So it's more aware. And I think, you know, we've, as a group, I think we've just become more institutionally powerful.
Oh yeah, that was
and again, you don't always see it because a lot of this stuff happens behind closed doors and in meetings, but it really matters who's in the meeting and who's at that table where high-level decisions are being made. And I think that's that this moment at Michigan is really about having a cohort of faculty of color who are playing really powerful roles across the university. Mm. And again, it's not, you don't know if you see us together. So I think people don't realize what that means. And every once in a while, we've been known to kind of flex our collective muscles.
You know? Mm. I really like that, flex our collective muscle. I mean, that was one thing Cynthia had pointed out during our panel discussion, mostly that we're not institutionalized. Although we worked together pretty well, we just didn't have this sense of collectiveness, so to speak, according to her. So it made sense hearing it from you, the way you're putting it, institutionalized. Thank you so much. In 5-10 years from now, where do you think that will be? Like, what are your future, would I say goals or perspective? I mean, you might not be able to really control it when it comes to goals, but where do you see that in 5-10 years from now?
So I think it's, you know, when you're looking at a historical trajectory, there are always some points where you're leaping ahead, and then there are other points where you're going backwards, and then sometimes you're going off to the side. And so yes, it's kind of hard.
Everywhere, all over.
It's hard to get a picture. But yes. I think one of the things that happened in the last, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years, is that DAS started to whiten, which, I mean, and nobody set out to say we need more white faculty. That's not how those things happen. It's just, you know, kind of for whatever, you know, collection of small decisions that were being made, the product was, you know, a faculty that was starting to look a lot whiter.
Mm.
And so I think there's now been kind of a more deliberate effort to kind of readjust the racial balance inside of DAS, which is, kind of interesting, right? So I think that's one way that you can see us moving. I think, you know, hopefully DAS will become a little bit more responsive again towards its undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
I think for some reason that there's something that was kind of lost there. So, you know, there were fewer majors, fewer minors. I kind of felt like, you know, that the undergraduate population wasn't as central for the faculty, you know, as it had been in past periods. So having Beth kind of disguise this fact, you know, because she's still connected to those students, but the department, not so much, right? So I think, you know, that there's a move to make curricular changes, you know, to try and bring the undergraduates back into, you know, the community in stronger ways. So I think that's a good, you know, and I would hope that that's going to continue to grow. And then I think, you know, we've been really trying to hire younger junior faculty, because, you know, we're getting a little old.
Bringing
in your replacements, and I would hope that there'd be a real attempt to think more too about the graduate program.
That was going to be my follow-up question, because you said a lot about undergrad. Like, do we have PhD programs at all? I mean, I was looking up at Northwestern a while ago, and their PhD program seems to be, or maybe that was History Department, actually. Do we actually have PhD program for DAS here, 3 of them? We don't. Are there plans, or normally, across board, we don't have PhD programs for DAS, for like African and Afro-American studies?
That's right. So, well, I don't know. It's a decision of the faculty, you know, so we could do it if we wanted to, you know, but it's a lot of work and it's a lot of effort to figure out how to structure it in the right ways. There was one point where DAS and American culture have been collaborating to have a PhD in African-American studies. I mean, that should have happened.
So what about politics?
No, I blame James Jackson. I just think he didn't do the stuff he needed to do. He just didn't keep that alive. He was busy with a lot of other stuff. He can't do everything, you know. Mm-hmm. But I would still blame him. And you should talk to him. He's fascinating. Really?
Okay, I will note that. James Jackson?
Yep.
Okay. Well, going forward.
He's still around campus, but he's, I think, technically retired.
Oh.
But the last position he had was the director of ISR.
ISR. Oh, the Institute of Social Responsibility or something. Oh, okay. James Jackson. But going forward, are there talks at all in the background, like behind the scene about PhD? I mean, because for me, really, having to just start working in this department, I wouldn't have, even though I don't think I'm going to do a PhD program. I don't want to, but it's something that has been fascinating me lately, just working in that space and working with some of the research I've been doing. It's just like, oh, it would be really nice to go into this and just represent yourself, I guess, represent what we stand for. Are there talks at all about the possibility of a PhD program in some, let's say, 10 years is too far away? Maybe 5 years?
I mean, I think, you know, the last time we were seriously thinking about it, Michigan State started their PhD program. Oh. Northwestern started a PhD program. I don't know. I mean, so all of a sudden the field got really crowded. And so I think we pulled back. I don't know. We'll see. I don't know that it's really come up in the department lately. Mm-hmm. Although I haven't really been going to department meetings when I was working in the dean's office. So I maybe don't have a good sense of that.
I mean, Beth could not really give me an answer to about that. I guess they've not really been talking so much about it, like you said. It would just be nice to have that in view.
And that's a real faculty-driven decision,
I guess.
So you would really want to get the perspective of, you know, a member of the faculty who's, you know, really been actively involved in that. Mm-hmm. So maybe Sandra Gunning could give you a good sense of it.
Okay. Thank you. What did you call his name?
Her name, Sandra.
I'm sorry, Sandra. Oh, thank you.
And she's been kind of overseeing our certificate program in AfroHound. So,
thank you. My last question would just be, I mean, and we probably touched a little bit on that when we started talking about Michigan State and Northwestern. Like, compared to other Africana studies in the country, how would you say we're faring? Like, are we measuring up, or are there ways we could do better? Are there ways we are even doing better than others? Like, what is your general take on that?
So we're definitely doing better than a lot of other places.
Oh, that's good to know.
I mean, so a lot of places aren't even, they're not departments, they're not augmented programs, they're just, you know, they're really struggling. They don't really have faculty, they don't really have a lot of control, it's just it's a mess, you know.
Wow.
I think so a place like Cornell, that's a hot mess.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, crazy.
Cornell University. Wow.
So I think we're probably kind of upper middle, you know, of the pack, you know, but because we are a department, do our own hiring, you know, no one is talking about getting rid of us. I mean, we are kind of an established fixture.
We are.
I mean, that's just, you know what I mean? So we can command resources.
Yeah.
But I think because we don't have a PhD program, I think we wouldn't be at the top, right? Because that's a measure of institutional strength, right? Yes. To have a PhD program.
Yep.
I mean, whether or not that's fair or not fair, I think that that's just the case. So I think we're good, but I think probably not the top. Definitely. And I think, you know, we're a little low in terms of majors and minors. And I think that matters too when you're gauging, you know, institutional strength. But one of the things I really like about Matthew Countryman, you know, in his time as chair, is that he's really focused on that. Mm-hmm. You know, because you have to be really responsive to the undergraduates in terms of the curriculum and the offerings and the advising. You know, it doesn't just happen. You really need to you know, to make that a priority.
Yeah.
And I think the last few years, it hasn't been as big of a priority as it should have been.
Oh, really?
But of course, I'm going to say that because I used to be the Associate Dean for Undergraduate Education.
So. Okay, I see where that is coming from.
That's a high bar for me about, you know,
how you measure it. Yep. And so you're saying, like, having that as a priority could probably be a game changer for us.
Hmm?
Having that as a priority, like having that consciousness of wanting to offer, I mean, just being in that space, it could possibly be a game changer for the department.
I think so.
Because my concern has actually been, I mean, that was my first questions to Beth, is that how can we get the enrollment high? Because what's the purpose of all of this if we don't have students in this programs, we don't even have programs to offer them?
That's right. So I think it's both numbers. So it's numbers of majors and minors,
mm-hmm.
but it's also numbers of students educated and served, you know, in other parts of the curriculum. And then I think there's something really important about the connections between undergraduates and the faculty. You know, so at times in DASA's history, you know, those relationships with the faculty were really strong,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there was, you know, there were real moments of coalition and being allies to students, helping them in moments when there are demonstrating against the university.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last kind of rounds of that from roughly 2013 forward, those kinds of relationships didn't really exist. I mean, I was really struck by that, you know. That, you know, mostly when, well, for instance, when my office was being protested by undergraduates, you know, there weren't really, you didn't really see the faculty. I mean, it was a really odd thing. So I think, you know, putting some of those relationships back together would be great.
I mean, just listening to you talk about this now actually sparked something I'd read about recently. I don't remember who was actually talking about or who wrote that, but she had mentioned how in time past there was this shared collectiveness, this it's our thing. But she said more like now, what we have now are faculty members wanting to, I mean, there's nothing bad with wanting to improve your career. There's nothing bad with wanting to be a better you. But she was actually making a point that seemed to have overwhelmed the idea of wanting to look out for one another, like that wanting to be in the face or in the space of those undergrad students. And then the race or the chase to like all the publications, wanting to be this, wanting to be that, I seem to have covered the idea that our forefathers, like the forerunners, had in mind. Would you say that is actually true? Because it seems as if you actually mentioned a little bit of that.
So maybe. I mean, I think it's pretty complex.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, a place like Michigan is a hard place to be a faculty member of color.
Yeah.
You know, and just kind of getting through the day, the week, the month, the semester sometimes can be just so hard. You know, it's like, what else do you want me to do? You know, I mean, it's just, you know, because of the microaggressions are bad, the kind of the treatment in some cases, not all. You know, it's just kind of disappointing. And then it really is hard to teach well and then keep up, you know, a really strong scholarly record, which you need to get promoted and to be taken seriously, right? I mean, so there's a lot of expectations, right, on the faculty. I do think, you know, I think that stuff about, you know, being in solidarity with the community, being in solidarity with students, going that extra mile, extending yourself, I think it's a question of leadership.
Mm.
And I think kind of, you know, at those moments when that's been strongest, you could kind of see it in the tone that the leadership of the department and the senior faculty took. So, I mean, I thought you could kind of see it. The last time I remember seeing that really strongly, that's probably unfair. But so when Taya Miles was chair, the winter of 2013, when there were students of color were really up in arms, and a lot of protesting, she constantly extended herself and through her DAS, right? So we were in dialogue with them. She was ordering pizzas, sending them over, opening up the department space for them to meet, those kinds of things. Martha Jones did that too. Stephen Ward has always kind of done that. I mean, so it's not that it's not there. I want to be really careful about that. But I think it's a while since it's been there as part of the whole logic of DAS. You know, that DAS exists for those kinds of moments.
Yes.
So that, you know, going all the way back to the legacy created by somebody like Niara.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But I think that nobody can do that constantly.
So, I know. True.
I don't want to ask, you
That's
know.
That's true.
I mean, you know, God. You know, and a lot of us feel like, you know, these jobs are already so hard. There's so many demands. There's so much departmental and institutional service. We get put on every committee in creation to make it diverse, you know. we do, I think, spend more time one-on-one trying to help students, you know, who are having problems. But, you know, at a certain point, we're worried about our health. We're worried about our sanity, you know, and we're kind of trying to keep body and soul together, you know, and so it can be hard to
keep that balance.
It can be hard to balance it out.
Yeah. It's actually funny hearing
it
from
you. We are tired.
Yeah. I only thought that it was us.
Black women.
Yeah. Agree, really. Seriously.
But I still think we do have an obligation, you know. And again, I think that's why in those moments when there's been strong leadership, to remind us that, look, I know you're tired, but we have an obligation to kind of be there, standing in solidarity with students in those moments.
I mean, speaking from a student perspective, we really do need that mentorship. Like sometimes I remember just coming into the program, I felt like I was lost in a world of, it was so huge. The university was like, where do I exactly want to start from? So it's essential to have some of those relationships to like go off from. And I mean, so funny to you. I didn't know that you guys are struggling. I really thought that we were the only one overwhelmed. I thought I was only our end. Like, oh my God, the overwhelming feeling is just out of here. But that's it. Right. Thank you so much, Professor. It's been so fun. Any last thoughts? Like anything you probably just want to share with me today?
Yeah, I think one is to, you know, talk to more people. You know, especially the previous directors. Okay. They're super interesting. And again, James Jackson is around. And, and I think James was the one who really expanded CAS's budget. He spent a lot of money. It's really interesting, you know. Earl Lewis is also here. He was a previous director of CAS. And now he's just back and has rejoined the faculty after being away for a long time.
Ooh.
So he went on to become the provost at Emory. And then he was president of the Mellon Foundation and is now back at Michigan and has rejoined the faculty.
Oh, okay. That's
good. So when I was a graduate student at Michigan, he was the director of CAS.
Oh. Were you also in CAS? Did you graduate from CAS?
American Culture.
Oh my, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Wow. As a student then, actually, what were your experiences? I mean, it's interesting. I really want to get your perspective. I didn't know that you were a student.
Yeah, I think it's probably a little different as a graduate student, though. you know. Okay. And I was here for like 4 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was just all about getting out of here. And so, you know, I mean, I worked with like some of the cast people, and I kind of knew the folks, and I really appreciated having that community around.
Yes.
And the co-chairs of my dissertation committee were Earl Lewis and Robin Kelly. They were just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Cass was still over in the old space, you know. It's actually when I first got to know Evans Young.
Okay.
He was the assistant director of Cass. He actually just passed away last week.
Oh, yes. Professor Matthew had mentioned something about that.
But he was he was amazing and has been a really important institutional presence, you know, across all those decades. You know, and it's really distinctive because he's Asian American.
Oh.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yes. I never pictured him. I mean, all through that conversation, I thought that it was just an African American. Wow, that's...
Yep. But really committed to racial justice. He had a Quaker background. I mean, just fascinating person. And actually, Earl Lewis just wrote a little bit about the decision to hire Evans as Cass's assistant director as one of the most consequential decisions that he's ever made. Wow. I know, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. I guess you just can't expect what happens sometimes. You can't predict it.
That's right. But, you know, they had really talked about the optics of that. Would that be okay? Would students accept him, you know?
Yes. So, well, did any of that happen?
He was great, as far as I know. I mean, he may have had some moments, you know, where things weren't as smooth, you know.
Well, human.
But he never talked about that to me, so, you know, I don't really know.
That's true.
And then years later, he was my assistant dean of undergraduate education.
Oh,
so we got to work together.
Yes.
Years later. And I was his boss.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of the way things shovel around in university, I mean, in that setting, it's just funny. Like, you're working with this person a few years, and then a few years down the line, the roles are reversed.
Yes.
That's interesting.
And I mean, in some ways, you know, academia is a lot smaller, you know, than people might think. And then, you know, I mean, I think one of the nice things about being, you know, faculty member of color and part of a community is that we all kind of, you know, not all, but a lot of us kind of know each other, or we share students in common, or, you know, that we have these kind of inner relationships. Mm-hmm. So for instance, I couldn't have been more delighted when I turned over the reins of Cass to Taya Miles, who was gonna be the first chair. So she was one of my first graduate students.
What?
I know, right? I was on her dissertation committee.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, we've known each other for a long time also. At the University of Minnesota. So, you know, it's just kind of, it's just weird how that stuff happens, you know.
I mean, the world is really a small world, come to think of
it. It is. And academia, again, is not that large. And we're like just kind of networked in these weird ways. So,
I totally agree.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time with me this evening. Out of your busy schedule, you took out this time.
No problem.
I am so grateful.
It's a cool project. And again, I'm going to see if I can find any documents here that you might.
That would be so helpful. Yeah, that would be so helpful.
I've been trying to find that. I had to write a formal request.
Okay.
To the LSA Dean's office requesting departmentalization.
And letting
them know that our new name was going to be the Department of Afro-American and African Studies.
Hmm.
Oh, so here's one more funny story.
Okay.
So there was like a form or something where, or I knew that I had to tell them what the name was going to be.
Okay.
And, you know, the thing about academics and faculty members and professors, they will talk things to death. I mean, yeah, I was like, we're not even discussing this. I just put it in as the Department of Afro-American and African Studies. So we were just going to change the C to a D and not open it for discussion.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Because
The name is already a little weird, right? The way that Afro-American is written, you know. Yes, so we could have made other changes. But I was like, I don't have time for it.
I mean, that saved you a lot of time, I guess.
Yes. And a lot of aggravation.
Yes. Yeah, it did work out. It did work out. Oh, thank you.
Sure.
This has been so informative. It's been so
fun.
Hearing stories from folks like you guys that have gone ahead of us. A lot of before we were even born. It's so nice to know.
Well, you don't have to put it that way.
No. Definitely not. I just needed the concept. Yeah. No, I didn't mean that though. I'm just like having to learn from you guys. It's
great. Well, good luck with the project. I can't wait to see what you come up with. And let me know if there's anything else I can do.
I'll definitely keep in touch. Good. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.